Good day. Today is Saturday, 2nd May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this programme, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Well, the big news over the last 24 hours is, in my opinion, the news that the United States has informed its European allies that it is scaling down weapons deliveries to Europe. It has informed the Europeans that inventories in the United States are now low, and that in light of this, the United States has to prioritize its own inventories first, the rebuilding of its own inventories after the conflict with Iran, and that means that there will be fewer weapons to provide to Europe and by extension to Ukraine. And we have a report about this in the Financial Times. US warns Europe of delays to arms shipments as Iran war drains stockpiles. And the subtitle is deferred deliveries could include those used in Ukraine's defense against Russia. And the article then continues, Washington has warned European allies, including Britain, Poland, Lithuania and Estonia, to expect long delivery delays for US weapons as it scrambles to replenish stockpiles depleted by the Iran war. The Pentagon has told the countries to expect serious delays for several missile systems, according to 9 people familiar with the matter. 2 people said there was also talk about postponing shipments to Asia. The delays are partly driven by acute concerns about US inventory levels, given the high volume of weapons used in the past 2 months in Iran. The American military has already been forced to move weapons from other regions, including the Indo-Pacific, to make up for shortfalls. The Iran war has also deepened concerns about whether the United States has sufficient stockpile of weapons to deter Beijing or defeat China in any future conflict over Taiwan. By the way, I can answer that question very quickly and very briefly. No, it doesn't. If the United States has run short of weapons to this degree after 2 months of fighting Iran and after 4 years of a conflict in Ukraine in which it has not been directly involved, then there is absolutely no chance that it can put together a stockpile of weapons large enough to defer China, by far the biggest manufacturing economy on earth. But anyway, let's not get sidetracked. Where the Financial Times says that in addition to sparking alarm across Europe, the delays are bad news for Ukraine amid concerns about US support for the country after 4 years of war since Russia's full-scale invasion. And the article goes on to say that amongst the weapons that are now in critically short supply are munitions for HIMARS, and I'm going to guess that that means ATACMS missiles, and NASAMS, which are air defense missiles, co-produced by the United States and Norway. Anyway, there it is. This has been a situation that has been developing over a very long time. If you have been following commentaries by Brian Beletic on the new Atlas, by people like Alex Vershinin, by people like myself on this channel, and us, Alex and myself, on the Duran, this would come as no surprise it's been obvious since very early on that the United States has been unable to keep up with the pace of fighting in Ukraine. Already, as I remember, during Ukraine's summer 2023 offensive, the United States was starting to run short of shells and had to supply Ukraine with cluster munitions in place of unitary shells. And, well, a few months ago, I discussed the fact that expectations that the United States would be able to ramp up shell production rapidly with the production of a new factory have not been fulfilled. And there's been much other information about production problems, blockages in US production of weapons. And interestingly, there's also now been an article in the New York Times published shortly before this latest article, which also spoke about the problems of shell production, of weapons production in the United States. The article discussed how the United States military has been found inadequate to the challenges of modern war, that the United States produces weapons. I won't say they're obsolete weapons, but weapons, big, large, expensive, highly sophisticated weapons like aircraft and tanks and that kind of thing, intended to combat other countries' aircraft and tanks, but that it has been left behind by modern developments in modern war, and that the US military industrial complex is no longer fit for use, that it has become unduly centralized, that it is resistant to change and adaption, and that the overall decline in the US's industrial base, the hollowing out of US industry, is compounding all of these problems. Well, there it is. We have been discussing these problems, as I said, for several years now on this channel, on the Duran, and now it seems, as I said, that we are there. And apparently in Kiev, Zelensky himself has come to recognize that the days of huge supplies of weapons from the West, of missiles and aircraft and air defense missiles and tanks and armored vehicles and shells, all of that is coming to an end. Only drones are left, and as I've discussed again in many programs, it's because the Europeans can assist the Ukrainians to make at least first-person view drones in significant quantities. That is one of the reasons why we hear so much about drones and why drones have become the latest weapon that is being presented to us as the wonder weapon that is going to save Ukraine. Even though, as I will discuss later in this program, that simply isn't so. Well, there it is. Now, the other thing to say is that this reduction in American weapons supplies to Europe is going to go hand in hand with the US decision to pull 5,000 troops out of Germany. And this is attracting a great deal of attention. The United States, until a few days ago, had 35,000 troops in Germany. Now 5,000 of those troops are being pulled out. It is not a massive reduction, but it is not an insignificant one either. And the German leadership is expressing dismay about this. About a year ago, the brilliant French commentator, who writes mostly about Chinese matters, pointed out that behind all the bluster, behind all the bluff, and all the brave words and all of this, I'm talking now about Arnaud Bertrand, behind all the bluster and the brave words, the United States was actually pulling assets out of Asia. If one examined, if one looked at the true scale of the American footprint in Asia, what one actually saw was not evidence of build-up so much as of retreat. And I can say that Arnaud Bertrand is actually right about this. I've heard this confirmed by others. I've seen this confirmed by others. I believe it's been picked up in China itself, by the way. They've also started to notice that the reality is that the American military footprint in Asia, even before the Iran war, was reducing. And then, of course, the conflict with Iran began on the 28th of February, and the United States found itself obliged to transfer more military assets from Asia. The THAAD systems deployed in South Korea, the USS Tripoli amphibious carrier, I believe the USS Lincoln was originally based in the Indo-Pacific region as well. And, well, the conflict with Iran looks like it is increasingly absorbing and pulling in US assets from the Asia-Pacific region. And we start to see that it is beginning to do the same with US military assets in Europe. Long ago, I think it was back in 2018, after one of the perennial US Pentagon military review documents, I actually wrote a piece about, which you can find actually on the Durand website, talking about US military overextension and suggesting that what the United States really needed to work towards was a geopolitical ceasefire with its main adversaries, China, Russia, and to some extent even Iran. In other words, what I was suggesting was that the United States needed a period of détente. That has not really happened. On the contrary, first under the Biden administration, and then even more under Trump since his inauguration in January last year, the United States has, on the contrary, ramped up its confrontation with its various adversaries. And the result is that this overextension is now increasingly hitting home. And the United States is having to pull back, draw back on some of its commitments. This has nothing to do with motivations or intentions or geopolitical plans or the continuing desire in the United States to maintain global hegemony. Many people in the United States remain fully committed to maintaining all of these things. In fact, in some respects, under this administration, that degree of commitment has, if anything, intensified. What is working against fulfillment of these broader plans is the underlying military industrial realities. The United States is struggling to adapt its armed forces to the return of great power rivals who possess immense industrial capacities. It is finding it difficult to adapt to the realities of changes in modern warfare, the new technologies and the new weapon systems that have been starting to appear and to proliferate. And it is these factors, not any lack of overarching ambition, that are starting to impose constraints on what the United States is able to do. I've discussed this in many places. I've spoken about this in articles and in interviews and on programs on this channel. The neocons, who are the people who act as prime drivers of this, prime ideological drivers of this forward policy that the United States has been trying to follow, they overemphasize will and neglect the issue of resource and capabilities. The will may be there, but the resources, quite simply, no longer are. Now, all of this certainly does leave Zelensky and the government in Ukraine with considerable problems. But of course, it also leaves Europe, the current European leadership, in difficulties, and no one more so than Germany's increasingly hapless chancellor, Friedrich Merz. Last year, when he finally became chancellor, he did so on the basis, in part, of claims that he was the man who would be able to establish a good and friendly relationship with Donald Trump, who would restore the US-German relationship back to its former fully functioning level. And, well, instead of that, we find him now in bitter conflict with Donald Trump. Very foolishly, he made statements about how the United States had been humiliated by Iran. Trump is furious about this, and people are linking the withdrawal of 5,000 US troops from Germany to this fact. My own view is that the United States has been finding it increasingly difficult to maintain the size of its military footprint in Europe for some time, and that sooner or later, probably sooner rather than later, those 5,000 troops were going to be withdrawn anyway. But the timing may indeed have been affected by the current disputes between Trump and Merz. And, well, all of this undermines something else that Merz has been trying to do, which is his much vaunted, oversold rearmament drive. Now, I've argued in many places that all this talk about putting German car factories and all of that on a military footing, ramping up production, getting car factories to produce armored vehicles and all of this has been talked about by excited commentators who have little understanding of engineering and military industrial realities. Germany actually is one of the least adapted countries to doing things of this kind. If you know anything at all about German industry, one of its features is its tendency to over-engineer products. The idea that factories can be, in Germany of all places, can be adapted quickly to churn out large numbers of cheap and basic armoured vehicles. As I said, doesn't understand the country or the industrial system or indeed industries generally. In my opinion, the funding that Merz is providing to the German auto industry should be more properly seen as a bailout of an auto industry reeling in the face of high energy costs and increasingly strong Chinese competition, rather than a real, genuine, properly thought out industrial program. But anyway, a military industrial program. But anyway, put all that aside, the reality has always been that to the extent that Merz really has been planning to increase the size of the German armed forces, it has depended heavily on increased weapons purchases from the United States. If that's not going to happen, the whole idea of a German military build-up in the next few years begins to, well, lose substance. And what you're going to get, as I've discussed many times, is a lot more debt, but not much more increase in overall military capability. And, well, that's probably a problem for the future. The other problem with Merz's rearmament drive is that it has already been unpopular in Germany. And in terms of the situation with the German economy, we've had stagnant growth, in other words, a stagnant or declining economy since 2022. And bear in mind, that's a stagnant and declining economy since 2022. But before 2022, there was the pandemic. You have to go back to 2019 for a time when it was possible to speak of a German economy that was in a superficially strong place. So inevitably, unavoidably, that is starting to affect the mood. Well, that is causing deepening dismay and a troubled mood in Germany. And of course, that's already feeding through into growing unpopularity for Chancellor Merz. And recently, I speculated that recent regional election results which did not go so badly for the CDU, might explain why there's been little dissent towards Merz from within the CDU up to now. But I have now revised that opinion. I now understand that, in fact, there has been considerable dissent, or rather considerable grumbling about Merz within the parliamentary faction of the CDU. And the other party in the German coalition, the SPD, whose electoral results up to now have been catastrophic, well, they apparently are also now seriously reconsidering whether remaining in coalition with Merz in terms of their very survival as a party is such a good idea. Now, I've heard many claims that in this situation, there is a real possibility that the Merz coalition might unravel, might break down. I've always found this very difficult to believe. Quite apart from anything else, would any of the establishment parties in the Bundestag, the CDU, the SPD, really want to see a new election, a breakdown of the coalition, perhaps leading to a new election, which, given the present state of the opinion polls, is likely to result in the AfD emerging as Germany's biggest party. So I have discounted this theory, but I'm now beginning to wonder whether, in fact, in a country like Germany, the whole position of the Merz government is indeed beginning to become unstable and might indeed start to break down. I suspect that an awful lot is going on in Germany under the surface, that the regional establishments that have previously supported the CDU have perhaps begun to revisit the idea of whether the AfD is really such an impossible partner in terms of Germany's government, as has been spoken about in the past. There might be suggestions that in the event that the current coalition falls apart, that the CDU, under a different chancellor, might want to rethink the question of entering into some kind of coalition with the AfD. Perhaps that might be an option to revisit after a future Bundestag election, the possibility of a right-wing coalition bringing together the CDU and the AfD might suddenly begin to be, for some people in German industry, in German business, in the oligarchies, the regional oligarchies that have been essential in Germany in supporting the CDU throughout its long post-Second World War history, it might be becoming increasingly attractive to them. This may seem very far-fetched at the moment, but I have to say that I am beginning to wonder. And, well, some of the recent displays, some of the recent performances of Merz, his recent comments, his very strange interview to Der Spiegel, complaining about the fact that nobody seems to like him, which has provoked a rather mocking cartoon image of him, cartoon film of him, which, well, you can actually find if you want to. I wonder whether this perhaps reflects some of the growing stress that he is under. Now, I want to stress this is not a prediction, and I can imagine many people starting to push back against this. But I'm starting to think that what I am discussing is no longer quite as far-fetched or as impossible as it looked just 6 months ago. And, well, a change of course is certainly needed because soon we are going to see a mounting economic decline in Europe as the problems with energy shortage start to hit home. Bloomberg has published an article saying that the big oil companies are now warning that the buffers in terms of reserves of oil are about to run out. I saw another report which spoke about the Europeans ramping up as fast as they can big purchases of LNG, presumably from the United States. Apparently, purchases of LNG are running at record levels because, again, of worries about the energy situation in Europe this coming winter. And I noticed that Japan also has now apparently resumed buying oil from Russia, from Sakhalin. The Japanese are careful to point out that these oil purchases have been exempted from sanctions, from Western sanctions. And I understand that Japan has begun buying this oil from the Russians, now in total disregard of the G7 oil price cap. So, well, the tensions in the energy markets appear to be intensifying. This is going to hit Germany particularly hard, given the structure of Germany's economy. A rapid adjustment would seem to be called for, a change in the course that the ship is taking. And, well, if dropping the pilot, Friedrich Merz, who is guiding the ship towards the rocks, is the price to be paid, I can imagine all sorts of people in Germany who are not particularly worried about paying that price. Now, if that in turn does indeed happen, then that is the final end of Project Ukraine. The kind of government that I'm talking about in Germany, if it ever forms, is no longer going to be committed to support for Ukraine. That is something that I am sure the AfD would insist on. I get the sense that the AfD has mostly won this argument amongst German business and elite opinion. And with the United States now also looking increasingly uninterested in continued support for Ukraine, and apparently Zelensky has been telling his officials, there's a report, I think it was in Reuters, that Zelensky has been informing his officials that there no longer appears to be much engagement or interest in Ukraine-related matters in the United States anymore. There continue to be some holdouts, people like Senator McConnell, who, however, is due to retire at the end of January when the new Congress in the United States is inaugurated. There are still also quite a few people on the Democrat side who remain keen to continue supporting Ukraine. But again, I get the sense that even the Democrats, are no longer as focused on Ukraine as they used to be. Anyway, American interest in the war in Ukraine has been fading. And, well, if there is this change of direction in Germany, I suspect that that really will be the end of Project Ukraine, because to the extent that the Ukrainians have been looking for a supporter, a backer in the West to make up for the slackening of help that they have been getting from the United States, they've increasingly been obliged to turn to the Germans. It is Friedrich Merz, who continues to write out the big checks. I spoke about the 20 billion euros that he's apparently going to give to the Ukrainians as Germany's share of the 90 billion euro loan, which is not a loan, just to say. I can't imagine any future German government being willing to do that. And, well, if the Germans do finally lose interest in this affair or give up on it, then it's impossible to see anyone else stepping in and taking up the slack. The British may talk a lot about their support for Ukraine. In British terms, they have given a great deal of money to Ukraine. King Charles III might go to Congress and might talk about the importance of continuing support for Ukraine. But the reality is, as everyone knows, that Britain has neither the financial nor the industrial, nor the military resources to sustain Ukraine by itself. Without the Germans and without the Americans, it all becomes impossible. So that's my own view about where we may be heading. Of course, this may be wrong. It may be that Merz will cling on and will continue to lead Germany down this, the direction that he has already been taking, which, as I've said, will be disastrous for Germany. But this reduction of the American military footprint in Europe, the reduction of American weapons supplies to Europe, to my mind, simply because of the military-industrial realities, points to the same kind of gradual pullback from Europe that Arnaud Bertrand has been talking about in Asia. And Germany doesn't have the ability to take up the slack by itself, regardless of what Merz wants. And I have reasons to think that in Germany, increasing numbers of people are starting to see this and that the ground there may be shifting. Well, there it is. That's my opinion today. That is my analysis. We will see whether I am right. In the meantime, of course, the war in Ukraine goes on. In a few days, the Russians will be celebrating their victory parade on the 9th of May. Vladimir Putin, as he regularly does now, to the intense annoyance, by the way, of the Russian military, or at least the Russian military leadership, has announced another short-duration ceasefire, apparently covering the actual celebrations on the 9th of May itself. the Ukrainians will ignore the ceasefire because they don't actually celebrate Victory Day on the 9th of May anymore, just saying. And, well, reality is this ceasefire is going to make absolutely no difference to the war whatsoever. And the war itself, goes on. Now, over the last few hours, the Russian leadership, the foreign ministry, have been placing heavy emphasis on an event that took place 12 years ago, shortly after the Maidan change of power in Ukraine, the Maidan coup, as the Russians always now speak about it. And by the way, just to make it clear, in my opinion, it was also, it was a coup. But anyway, an event that took place 12 years ago, shortly after those events, and that is the fire that took place in the trade union building in Odessa, when protesters against the new government or regime that had established itself in Kiev, in Odessa, basically withdrew into a trade union building in Odessa, which was then set on fire. Now, this is a ghastly affair, one which has never attracted in the West the attention that it deserves, but one which played a role in shaping Russian opinion of the whole crisis in Ukraine. And when I mean Russian opinion, I mean Russian public opinion of the crisis in Ukraine, which simply cannot be overstated. Firstly, this event took place in Odessa, a city of enormous emotional significance to the Russians, as a major historic city built by Catherine the Great, a city that has played a pivotal role in Russian culture and Russian history, a city which is considered a hero city because of the way it was defended and defended itself during the Second World War. That already would have ensured that the event, an event in Odessa, would have attracted a huge amount of attention across Russia. Another factor, I have no doubt, is the fact that this incident took place between two critically important holidays. The 1st of May, which continues to be celebrated as a holiday in Russia, and the 9th of May, which is a the day when the Russians celebrate their country's victory over Germany in the Second World War. And of course, not just victory over Germany, the country, but over the ideology that Germany had adopted during the Second World War, and which I'm, because of the sensitivities on this platform, I have to be very careful in talking about. But that ideology, which for the Russians, it was a central part of the Second World War for the Russian people to fight against. And the third factor was the gruesome nature of what took place, the deaths of many people, many protesters, who of course were protesters, who identified themselves with Russia and with Russian culture, and the fact that they were attacked and that the fire is universally believed in Russia to have been started by Ukrainian activists who not only were vehemently hostile to Russia, but who, to the Russian mind, in Russian belief, and actually in reality, in many cases, support or continue that ideology that held power in Germany in the 1940s, which the Russians defeated in the Second World War. So all of this was a shock, and it was a transformative event. After what happened in the Odessa fire, it became impossible, in my opinion, for Russia and Ukraine, the new Ukraine, to establish normal relations. It was something that, even if there had been a desire to do it in the Kremlin, would have gone so much against the tide of opinion in Russia itself that it would have been all but impossible. Well, the Russians have repeatedly, over the years, spoken up about the Odessa fire. Putin himself has done so, but the Foreign Ministry has now released a statement about the Odessa fire, and it says that Ukraine has repeatedly broken its promise to identify and bring the perpetrators of that fire to justice. By the way, that is basically true. There's been minimal attempt by the Ukrainian authorities to investigate or prosecute this incident. And that the justice for the victims of that fire will be achieved when the objectives of the special military operation are achieved. Now that, it seems to me, is an exceptionally important statement, because what it effectively says is that an event that took place in Odessa will only be treated justly, will only receive justice as a result of Russia's achievement of its political and military goal in the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. In other words, the goal of the military operation, the special military operation, now extends to bringing to justice an event, those responsible for an event that took place in Odessa itself. It's the first occasion I am aware of where the Russians, the Foreign Ministry, an institution of the Russian state, has linked directly the special military operation with Odessa. Now, back in the late autumn, early winter of last year, I pointed out that an unusual event took place, consequent upon a meeting that took place between Putin and the military commanders involved in the special military operation. Putin met with them in St. Petersburg. He took them to the Peter and Paul Fortress. He brought them before the tombs of Peter the Great and Catherine the Great. Catherine the Great was the founder of Odessa. It seemed to me, both from the briefing that Putin was given and from this really remarkable gesture which Putin gave, that Putin was clearly signalling that the special military operation would only be completed once Odessa itself had been brought in some way under Russian control. And on that, I noticed something further as well, which is that in a meeting with military officials, that the Russian commander of the Russian forces in the area of the special military operation undertook a meeting, a photograph of this meeting, the commander, of course, being General Gerasimov. Behind Gerasimov, there was a map which showed all of southeastern Ukraine under Russian control, including Odessa itself. Well, it seems to me that these comments from the Russians, this highlighting of the event that took place in Odessa in 2014, in May 2014, gives a clear further clue about long-term Russian intentions. One way or the other, in some form or other, the Russians intend that Odessa will be liberated from the current regime, as they call it, in Kiev. And personally, I have no doubt that the long-term objective is to reunite it, as the Russians would say, to the motherland. Now, that brings me to certain comments that the head of the Donetsk regional government, I should say the Russian-backed Donetsk regional government, Denis Pushilin, has also made. He has said that there is no possibility, no mechanism whereby the current government in Kiev can be ousted from power by any form of political process. He said that the government, the regime in Kiev, has entrenched itself. It has used its control of the SBU, the counterintelligence agency, which many say has evolved into a kind of secret police organization, to eliminate all of its opponents. Its opponents are either dead or in prison or in exile. That sustained protest to achieve its overthrow in today's Ukraine is impossible. And, well, given that the Russians have increasingly made clear that the government in Kiev itself is, as far as they are concerned, the fundamental obstacle to peace in Ukraine and to a peaceful resolution of the conflict in Ukraine. The logic of what Pushilin said, well, it seems to me that it clearly points to a plan to eventually remove by force in some way that government. Now, again, it's perhaps unwise to talk of timelines, but that it does, it seems to me, is now essentially the Russian objective. And if we go back to that conversation between Putin and Trump, which took place a few days ago, in the, I suspect, relatively brief comments that Putin and Trump exchanged about the situation in Ukraine, it's interesting that Putin apparently got Trump to agree that it was indeed Zelensky and the government in Ukraine that is the chief obstacle to a resolution of the conflict. And given what Pushilin is saying about the impossibility of changing that government by political means, well, again, you could see where things are going. Putin himself also considers that Zelensky is the primary obstacle to peace, and he too presumably accepts the opinion of Pushilin that it is impossible to change that government constitutionally or politically. Putin, of course, does not accept that Zelensky is even Ukraine's legitimate president, according to the Ukrainian constitution. To me, everything clearly points in the same direction. Anyway, there it is. That's again my view. It's not something that is new to me. I have always believed, ever since the special military operation began, that it would be all but inconceivable for the special military operation to end without some change in Odessa's status having taken place. And, well, the events of the last few hours confirm that fact. In the meantime, the war itself goes on. And, well, there continues to be a great deal of fighting. And there's been a huge amount of commentary about the introduction by the Russians of their new technology, whereby drones, the Geran drones, as they conduct strikes across Ukraine, are able to talk to each other. And that is indeed taking place, and it is indeed interesting. And I would reiterate again that it is not an entirely new technology, not by any means, but it is perhaps interesting that it has been introduced by the Russians into drone warfare. It apparently also makes it much easier for the Russians to control their drone swarms and to guide their drone swarms to attack targets. By the way, I understand that the new Russian satellite systems that the Russians now have, which substitute for Starlink, are also in operation, and probably they're also going to start to provide a role in providing further guidance in this area. But anyway, the point is, the drone attacks by the Russians continue. They continue all the time in every part of Ukraine. But I noticed that the latest attacks, as well as being focused heavily on central Ukraine, also again appeared to include the Odessa region. And to me, it's been looking for some time as if the major objective of Russian drone and missile strikes on Odessa, on the Odessa region, is specifically to cut off rail and road links to Odessa in order to prevent possible deployment of European forces from NATO territory to Odessa in the event of an actual Russian military operation to capture this city. Anyway, a lot, as I said, written and discussed about the drone wars. I would add that the fire in Tuapse, which has attracted a lot of commentary, appears to have been put out. I am myself of the view that the attacks on Tuapse were mostly made possible by lack of air defences around the town and the refinery. I suspect that the absence of air defences probably was connected to the belief that as this refinery apparently processes oil from Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan, destined for Western customers, the Ukrainians would not attack it, because of course it's not just the Ukrainians, their drones are guided, as everyone knows, by information provided by Ukraine's Western sponsors. But anyway, I'm not going to explore this further. I am confident that Tuapse, the refinery, will be quickly repaired and that the air defences around the refinery will be strengthened. And in a few weeks' time, a month's time, the refinery will be back in operation and we will see exports from Tuapse resume. But in the meantime, the ground war continues. And, well, there has been fighting in Zaporozhye region and more fighting in the north around Slavyansk and Liman. And, well, I could spend a lot of time discussing all the details of these particular battles. There's also, by the way, and this is perhaps the most curious or surprising piece of information for some people, less so to me. There's also been information or drone footage which purportedly shows, the drone footage is not very, shall we say, it's not incontestable, but it appears to show, or claims that it shows, Russian soldiers operating well to the west now of Kupiansk, which, if true, must mean that not only is Kupiansk itself, I mean now the city of Kupiansk, on the west bank of the Oskol River, firmly under Russian control, but that the Russians have actually advanced far to the west of it. Anyway, the drone footage, as I said, is contentious, and I'm not going to dwell much on that. The big battle continues to be in Konstantinivka. There's been, as I said yesterday, there's been information that the Russians have taken to dropping leaflets on the Ukrainian defenders of Konstantinivka, calling on them to either surrender or withdraw. There's been more reports that after the capture of Ilinovka, and in the west of Konstantinovka and Novodimitrovka, to the east of Konstantinovka, that the Ukrainian forces in Konstantinovka are indeed in significant disarray, and that the Russian pincers are closing. Supposedly another high-rise building area in southwestern Konstantinovka has fallen under Russian control. I suspect that's, if that's true, that's probably the last important area of high-rise buildings. My own view is that this is indeed, we are indeed now starting to see the end of the battle. I think it is quite likely that in a few days' time, we will have claims from the Russians about a cauldron being established in Konstantinovka. Cauldrons can take a significant amount of time to extinguish or to eliminate. But one way or the other, my own view is that the Battle of Konstantinovka, the main part of the Battle of Konstantinovka, is basically ended. We are seeing in Konstantinovka essentially a repeat of the Battle of Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. And I'm going to make a further speculation here that, as in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, where I understand the Russians suffered relatively light losses, the same will turn out to be true of Konstantinovka as well. Fall of Konstantinovka and probably the parallel fall of Liman in the north will be the critical moment in the Battle of Donbass. From that point onward, it will be clear, even to the most committed people in Kiev, that the battle for Donbass is lost. There's been some claims, some reports circulating, that we're about to see another period of instability in Kiev, that the corruption scandal that we saw 6 months ago is about to restart. That could be true. Zelensky was able to survive that corruption scandal. I suspect that he will still be, despite the shortage of weapons supplies and all of those things, if, of course, there is the kind of change of power in Germany that I was talking about earlier in this program, well, then, of course, everything in that respect changes also. But, of course, those events are probably some weeks or months away at the very least. So anyway, that is the overall military situation in Ukraine today. Now, on the question of drones, one which attracts a huge amount of attention, I noticed that the Russian air defense contractor, Almaz-Ante, the Russian company that produces the radars, the air defense missiles, the country that in fact basically invented modern air defense. Of course, not Almaz-Ante itself, but the various design bureaus that were set up in the Soviet Union at the end of the 1940s and the beginning of the 1950s, and which pioneered development of surface-to-air missiles and their accompanying radar systems and control and command and control systems. Anyway, Almaz Ante are now saying that they have completed the systems architecture and concepts and much of the hardware for a drone tracking system. I suspect we will soon see that in operation. I think this is more likely to be to counter what you might call strategic drones of the kind that the Ukrainians have been using to conduct attacks inside Russia itself. The Russians have shown an extraordinary ability to be able to rush this kind of technology and this kind of equipment into service very fast, and I expect that we will start to see it appear in service at some point within the next few weeks. And I also suspect, by the way, that we will see growing effectiveness, growing success by the Russians in countering Ukrainian first-person view drones as well. Anyway, that's my summary of the military situation in Ukraine and the situation in Ukraine overall. On the topic of Russia, I would just quickly mention also some economic news. There was a lot of concern, but not concern, shall we say, there was some measure of celebration perhaps in the West about the fact that in January, Russia experienced a 2.2% GDP contraction year on year. That was followed by 1.1% GDP contraction in February. Well, as it happens, we have now seen a significant growth rebound. GDP, Russian GDP in March grew 1.8% year on year. There is still a certain amount of statistical refinement in these actually rather early figures, but the evidence does indeed now point to the Russian economy certainly avoiding recession this year. Just saying. Now, this big 1.8%, well, this is not, I'm not saying it's big, this 1.8% rebound in March obviously is unconnected to the events in the Middle East. The Russian government will not have received any receipts from higher oil sales as a result of in March, nor is it likely that we will have seen any boost in oil production or big ramp up in exports that would have figured in these GDP statistics for March. I suspect that there's been a certain softening in monetary conditions. And it's also likely that the effect of the tax increases that took place in Russia in January has worn off, and that this has resulted in this rebound in GDP in March. I believe it came as a surprise to the Russian authorities and was bigger than they had anticipated. And by the way, and for the record, I noticed that the Russian authorities, Rostat, has now re-examined GDP figures for 2024 and has increased estimated GDP growth by Russia in 2024 to 4.9%, just below 5%. It now estimates that Russia achieved, in other words, essentially 5% GDP growth in 2024. And I anticipate, by the way, that GDP figures in 2025 are going to be revised upwards as well. I'm not going to discuss why I think that in this program. Anyway, all those articles about financial crises, overextended Russian budgets, collapses in production that you've been reading in the media, in the West, they have already been proved to be wrong, and they were being proved wrong even before the start of the Iran war and the increase in oil prices that has resulted from it. Just saying. Now, that finally brings me to the topic of the Iran war. The United States government, President Trump's administration, has come up with an interesting legal theory about why it does not need congressional approval to maintain the congressional approval to continue the conflict with Iran. The reason is that the conflict supposedly is over. The war has been terminated. The operations have been successful, and the sea blockade, because it is not a war as such, does not require congressional approval. Apparently, some members of Congress on the Democrat side were incredulous by this reasoning, but here's what I think. I think it will be accepted. I think that it will overall be accepted and that it will pass. And, well, the Iranians, of course, are saying that this leaves it open for Donald Trump to resume the war in 1 or 2 weeks' time. So it's not actually any new attack on Iran is not a continuation of the war that began on the 28th of February. It's actually an entirely new war that has started after the war that began on the 28th of February has been terminated. Well, I am not going to argue on the creative realities of all of this. What I can say with confidence is that Congress is not going to push back on any of this. In terms of Trump's war fighting, the fact is that he has a solid constituency that supports him in Congress, which will checkmate any move that seeks to rein him in. That is the extraordinary constitutional reality, but there it is. Speaking of Trump, and going back to my earlier comments about Germany, he apparently is now planning to impose 25% tariffs on the German auto industry. I'm not sure whether that is constitutional in light of the Supreme Court decision. I don't know to what extent it's having any effect on thinking in Germany. I'm going to explore that and think about that further before I discuss it in a future programme. But this is where I finish my program today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Also, please remember that you can tick the like button and check our subscriptions to this channel, your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.